The recording has started. This is the 9/11 and other deep state crimes teleconference for the 26th of October, 2016. Ken Freeland, Cheryl Curtis facilitating, Craig McKee secretary, and we will proceed now with a roll call. Craig, you can, Craig, I will read off the names that we have here to facilitate this, okay, and then anybody else you can add to the list, okay, since you're not able to see it. Wayne Costi, Pablo Novi, Ken Freeland, John O'Malley, James Hufford, Greg Longo, Frank Talopko, Edwin Jewett, Dick Attlee, Craig McKee, Cheryl Curtis, Pat McGuire, Barton Bruce, Barry Zwicker, Barbara Honegger. We have five other callers that need to be identified.
David Cole.
Richard Gage.
Richard Gage. Who else?
Hi, Richard.
Hi, guys.
Welcome, Richard. Who else is on the call that we didn't identify?
Sheila Casey.
Who else?
Xander Arena.
I'm sorry?
Xander Arena.
Xander, I thought I read your name. Didn't I read your name?
Oh, you may have. Sorry, I didn't.
If I didn't, then Xander, and then Dr. Griffin, of course. So that would be all of us, I think. Okay?
And yourself.
I'm sorry?
And yourself. You didn't give your name.
Anybody's name I did not mention who's on the call.
Yeah, Don Fox.
Don Fox. Thank you, Don. Yeah. Yes, okay, Don Fox. And so that should bring us up to speed, and we're ready now to proceed with our normal agenda, which would be, first of all, the approval of the previous minutes. Any objection to the minutes? Craig, I think I might need to work with you on using the exact wording of Cheryl's resolution that was passed. But other than that, I have no amendments. Any other amendments to the minutes? We will want to make sure that's reflected exactly. Okay, so hearing no other amendments, I'd like to ask that we approve that and move on. Hearing no objection, that's approved. We'll now move into tonight's draft agenda. Any objections to using tonight's draft agenda as circulated in tonight's meeting?
Well, it's Barbara. Are we still going to have announcements at the end?
Always announcements at the end. Yes, Barbara. And we're reserving first place. So anyway, yes, we'll have announcements at the end as always. So if there are no other objections, then we will proceed with our agenda tonight. I'm sorry, who just joined the call? Who just joined the call?
Jonathan Mark.
Jonathan Mark. Who else? Another person just joined the call.
If you're, you can hear us.
We're not able to hear you. Can you say it again?
Mike Cook.
Mike Cook. Are you just calling back in or what?
Yeah, I got dropped.
Okay. All right, thank you. So, all right, with no further ado then, tonight we're very honored to have with us Dr. David Ray Griffin, often called the Dean of the 9/11 Truth Movement. Nobody on this call probably needs an introduction to him, but since our calls are recorded and others listen, and since this is our first visit from Dr. Griffin to my recollection, Carol, who did the took the initiative to invite Dr. Griffin, will give us the introduction. Go ahead, Cheryl.
Thanks, Ken. Okay, well, it's a really great pleasure to introduce Dr. David Ray Griffin. He's a co-founder of the 9/11 Consensus Panel. He's Emeritus Professor of Philosophy of Religion and Theology at Claremont School of Theology and Claremont Graduate University. He's published 37 books, mostly in the philosophy of science and religion field, but 10 are about 9/11. The New Pearl Harbor Revisited, 9/11, The Cover-Up and the Exposé, was named Pick of the Week by Publishers Weekly in November of 2008. He was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize for his 9/11 work in both 2008 and 2009, and he was named one of the 50 people who matter today by the New Statesman in 2009. And he's here today tonight to tell us about his new book, How Bush and Cheney Ruined America. So David, welcome.
Thank you very much. I'm sorry I missed the call. I forgot to call you. My memory has gotten so bad, I need to have people call me about 2 minutes before I'm supposed to get on.
Excuse me, Dr. Griffin, before you proceed, what is your area code?
Oh, 805.
805. Okay, so I'm going to put us into lecture mode so that there won't be any background noise here, and then I'll unmute your phone and you can continue, okay?
Okay.
Cheryl, can you try to unmute Dr. Griffin? I'm not able to unmute him.
Good. Thank you.
Thank you. Oh yeah, you're all set to go, Dr. Griffin.
Okay. I'm not getting any response.
No, everyone's hearing you now. It's just that they're all muted except for the facilitators and yourself, okay?
Oh, I see. Okay. So Cheryl was going to say a little more?
Oh, I beg your pardon. Yes. Well, Cheryl shouldn't be muted. Cheryl, are you on the call? Uh-oh. Well, I think Cheryl probably didn't log in as host, but I'll unmute her just a moment here, please. It'll just take a second. Yeah, must not have muted in this, must have logged in this post.
Okay, you did unmute me?
There you go. Yeah, you're unmuted, don't you? Go ahead.
Okay, so, but no, I was done. I was finished.
But I don't think, you were. Okay, yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay, so you just want me to talk a little bit about my forthcoming book.
Yes, please.
Okay. So the full title is Bush and Cheney, How They Ruined America and the World. Now, that probably seems kind of like an exaggeration, but I think once one gets through the book, sure, there's some exaggeration, but once one gets through the book, you'll be surprised how much they did ruin America and the world. The first part of the book is about all that, how they ruined America and the world, 10 chapters. The second part of the book is about 9/11, and the title of that is Original Sin, 9/11. And it has 5 chapters, Why Bush and Cheney Should Not Be Trusted on 9/11, the miraculous destruction of the Twin Towers, the miraculous destruction of World Trade Center 7, the miraculous attack on the Pentagon, and the fifth one you will not have guessed probably, the miraculous transformation of Muhammad Atta. So as you can gather from these titles, I am not in this book trying to give an overview of all the problems with the official account, as I did in some previous books. This book, insofar as it focuses on 9/11, it focuses entirely on the miracles in the official story. And I'm assuming that people who read the book don't believe that miracles happen, and certainly don't believe they would have happened on 9/11 with Allah performing the miracles. So I take that as the strongest evidence possible that the official story is false, because we have about, forgot to count up here, about 11 or 13 miracles defined as things that couldn't possibly happen, or put it more particularly, things that violate the principles of chemistry and physics. Now, the introduction just gives a kind of what you would expect. but I talk in there about Bush and Cheney and their relationship, and in particular that during the first part of the Bush-Cheney administration, the first 4 years, Cheney was really serving as the president, as lots of critics have pointed out. It got somewhat different in the second semester, the second 4 years. But most of what went on that caused all the problems were Cheney's doing. And in fact, some people now call the position as Cheneyite or Cheneyism. And so, and the whole book is not just about those first 8 years. And so the book is really about Cheneyism, which has continued throughout the Obama period. I've got from my stroke, I got some aphasia, which not only prevents me from finding the words that I'm looking for, but it also gives me rather hilarious pronunciations quite often. Anyway, so in the Obama administration, they pretty much carried things forward. Obama's much friendlier, and he smiles a lot more than Cheney, and he's obviously a nicer guy, and so on and so on and so on. But in terms of the policies, not so much different. So I then go through the chapters. So the failure to prevent 9/11, there I deal with the one of the true things that Donald Trump has said when in his debate with Jeb Bush. You know, Jeb made the foolish statement of saying, well, you don't like my brother, but he did keep us safe. Well, then that caused a tremendous amount of discussion. And, of course, Trump was right. He did not keep us safe. And as one person put it, what didn't keep us safe either before or after 9/11? So the next nine chapters are all about how he did not keep us safe after 9/11. The next chapter is on the war on terror and the Afghanistan war. The following chapter is on military spending and preemptive war and regime change. Now, those are things that I had talked about in previous books, so pretty much I plagiarized myself. So those chapters are pretty easy to write. But then there's the chapter on the Iraq War, and that one is pivotal for the book because I emphasize, as have a lot of writers, how much the war was based on lies. And so that leads to jump ahead to the second part of the book, that chapter, Why Bush and Cheney Should Not Be Trusted on 9/11. It's strange how some people will say, well, yeah, they just told terrible lies about Iraq, lie after lie after lie. But then you say, well, what about 9/11 itself? Oh, no, that wasn't a lie. That was true. So I try to drive home that point that since they lied so much about Iraq, at least one ought to begin with skepticism that they likely lied a lot about 9/11 too. The next chapter is on Islamophobia. And that might seem strange, except that most of the things that happen that have turned to ruin or undermine the world depend on Islamophobia. So you've got people, especially in America, but in many other countries, in Europe in particular, that they have a lot of Islamophobia. It originated primarily, I mean, it is a longer lasting phenomenon that started, you know, back in the Middle Ages, but and then more recently, in the end of the 19th century, but I'm sorry, end of the 20th century, and now I distracted myself. let's see, where was I going? Oh, so that it makes it easier for people to understand and accept the fact that we are destroying so many Muslim countries. The thought being, well, Muslims are bad guys anyway, and actually, you know, and they did 9/11, so let's not get too worried about international law here, because maybe it's illegal to attack all those countries, but it's justifiable. So I think that's a fairly strong feature of what has been going on since 9/11. Then the really, really big chapter is on global chaos. And so there I focus on Libya and Syria primarily. And of course, Hillary was the one in the United States who was really pushing for a no-fly zone over Libya. And that was supposed to be just to protect the people. But of course, once that got started, it ended up in total destruction of the regime and destruction of much of the country and so on. And of course, now Hillary's doing it again with regard to Syria. So that's part of what I mean by Cheneyism continued through the Obama administration. Of course, she was there only the first, as Secretary of State, only the first 4 years. But she had so filled the State Department with her kind of people. You know, one of those is the wife of the chief neocon. And that's another thing I could say. I mean, the book is really about the neocons and their worldview. So she's got a number of people there. Also, a number of people are in the Pentagon that hold to basically the same neocon point of view. And so that's... it's understandable, therefore, that the same basic same kind of philosophy has continued. Now, Obama is somewhat different from Hillary, so he has held off on a. They've been begging him, both the Pentagon and the State Department, been begging him to attack Syria, and he almost did it about the so-called red line that was crossed, but he pulled back from that and still has continued to refuse. But they're very excited now that Hillary is most likely going to become president. And so that this pent-up urge to destroy another country has built up. And they're very excited that she's going to do it. In fact, she has explicitly said that she will work on the no-fly zone and then use that to bring about regime change. In fact, she evidently said in one of those WikiLeaks that her hope to make a name for herself and become somebody important in the history book is to bring about more regime change. And particularly not only with Syria, but believe it or not, Russia. So that's, I say, a very long chapter. Then I shift over to drone warfare and international law. And probably most of you know it is, you know, it's against international law, partly because it's outright murder. And that Obama has led the way here, and so there have been a lot of criticism of him for seemingly enjoying hitting people with drone strikes. And sometimes he even calls the strike himself. That's another long chapter. That's closely related to the Islamophobia because, again, we don't get too excited about that because we're killing Muslims. The next chapter is the one most central to destroying America. It's called Shredding the Constitution. And, of course, Obama was a constitutional lawyer. And they say was. He certainly doesn't act like one recently. But the thing is, he knows it so well that he was able to take all the illegal things that Cheney had put through, and Obama and his crew, his lawyers, were able to keep almost all of those things going by finding out ways to make them seem to be legal. Then come to Russia. That ninth chapter is on nuclear holocaust. And a lot of major writers have become increasingly concerned that we are so rabid about this climate change and regime change, and so this is where we're, you know, carrying through with the Cheney program most fully, is to try to bring out a unipolar world where America is in control of almost everything. Or actually, everything. Right now, it's only almost everything. Then, and there again, it was rooted in Cheney. And then the 10th chapter on ecological holocaust. And of course, I had recently written a whole book about that, so that chapter wasn't too difficult. But again, Cheney, to a great extent, was at the root of that. And Obama has been a little better, but not nearly enough better. And we just learned today, I believe, or yesterday, that Hillary and her crew don't really plan to carry through with their promise to Bernie to really work hard on climate change. And in fact, Podesta evidently called it, it was some word like crap or something like that. So that's the first part of the book. And then that is supposed to inspire readers who are not yet converted to, and this is the main thesis of the book, that the world is become in such bad shape over the last 16 years that we're about ready to do ourselves in at one or both of the two ways, the nuclear holocaust or the ecological holocaust. Also, many people would say the shredding the Constitution. We've destroyed America and so on. So my hope is that people will, at least look at that and say, well, Griffin doesn't seem like an idiot. His first chapter seemed pretty good, pretty scholarly, pretty, take account of the data. And so maybe we'll take a look at this book, this second part, and see why Bush and Cheney should not be trusted. And then, knowing that I say that the main objection to the official story is all of its miracles, well, they might get curious about what would those miracles be and so on. So that's basically it. Sorry for running over, Cheryl.
No problem, Dr. Griffin. Before we go to the question and answer mode, though, why don't you let folks know how they can get a hold of your book?
How to do what?
Get a hold of your book. How do they get your book?
Oh, yeah, that's right. I haven't been on the radio very much lately. The best thing is just to go to Amazon.com. Although, hopefully some of you are loyal to Interlink Press, which published all my previous books, and they're doing this one too. I do have a new editor, and that's another story in itself I won't go into.
So they have their own website where people can purchase directly from Interlink?
Just go to Interlink, they'll direct you where to buy it.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, we're ready for our first experiment with our question and answer mode, Ho. So let's. Okay. So if you want to ask a question or make a comment on what you've just heard, press *6 on your phone, and you will be entered into the queue. And I'm going to make very sure that Dr. Griffin was not muted here, but he was, so I'll have to unmute him here so he can respond. But press *6 on your phone if you wish to be in the queue. And I see we have at least one questioner already. So, yep, here we go. So I'll give you all just a moment, and then Dr. Griffin will respond to our first questioner. Let's go.
Oh, hello. I hope I'm heard. It's Barry Zwicker in Toronto, and it's just great.
Hi, Barry. It's been a long time.
Oh, it's been a long time. But you're always very present. I wouldn't say omnipresent, but very importantly present, and it's good to hear your voice again. Pardon?
Not quite omni.
Well, semi-omni.
Anyway, go ahead.
Anyway, I'm sure this book, from your for all the good reasons, will be, like your others, tremendously educative. And I wouldn't want to say how much I agree with your talk about ecological holocaust and the psychological angle, and of course climate change, and the question of hope. How are we going to do ourselves in? But I'll focus instead on a very specific thing, which is language per se, and then specifically regarding your use. And certainly, you have a lot of company. Your use of the word attack. or the word attacks in the context of the attacks of 9/11. So let me just raise a question here and suggest that the word attack in that context is almost a perfect condensation of the big official lie, because what it was an inside job, not an attack. And attack, unless we're talking of heart attack or uses like that, attack always means an outsider, you know, attacking us. And so it is a tremendously misleading single lie, I would say, single misleading thing. And so better, I would suggest, and I'm almost finished my question, we could use, for instance, the phrase inside job. That's those of us who do know the facts about it. It's in a well-known phrase. We could be more rhetorical and say the terror fraud of 9/11, but I know that's not your style. You're very careful. Another linguistic option is the neutral word events, as in the events of 9/11, and that word is used neutrally in science, say chemical events, and then more normally is cultural events or sports events. So my question, David, is, what do you think about choice of words or terms in our ongoing discourse about 9/11?
If I remember correctly, and I usually don't, I use the term attack primarily in relation to attack on Iraq and on Libya and on Syria. I don't remember, now maybe I used attack, well, I mean, in 9/11, it's understood as an attack. I don't think an attack has to be from another country. You know, all sorts of crimes are attacks on other people. With regard to, I use inside job a lot. But I don't see any objection to use the term the attacks of 9/11. They're attacks by our own government.
Thank you, Dr. Griffith. We're running very short on time, so please keep your questions very brief. And Dr. Griffin, if we could ask you to please respond as concisely as you can, just so that we can give everyone a chance to get the word in edgewise here, okay? We've got about five or six people waiting in the queue, so again, please keep your question very brief, and we'll try to move through as fast as we can. Thank you. Thank you, Mary.
Hi, I think it's my turn. This is Ed Jewett speaking. I want to say simply to Dr. Griffin and echo Barry's remarks, it's good to hear your voice. I consider you the dean of 9/11 Truth. I'm delighted to have met you and gotten an autographed copy. I have one question that I'm going to ask a lot of people, but you are at the top of the list. What is the single most important thing that the 9/11 Truth Movement needs to concern itself with?
You know, I think the truth has been enunciated enough times, and it became particularly clear once the scientists and the architects and engineers got involved. So if anybody will seriously look at the evidence, I don't think we need any more evidence. So I think what I'm trying to do in this book anyway is to try to find better ways to and get people to actually look at the evidence.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ed.
Hi, this is Dick Attlee. Since you were one of the first people to get me involved in this long ago, I really appreciate it. And some of us have been having concerns about what the impact of the 28 pages effort is on the 9/11 Truth Movement. Some people are gung-ho to do it and say it's the camel's nose under the tent and it's going to open up all kinds of things which we haven't yet seen happen. And some of us are concerned that it's basically confirming the official story in the public, and it's essentially a limited hangout that's going to let the perpetrator's off the hook at this point. And I'm wondering how you take all that.
Well, I think that's been basically my view of it, that the idea that the Saudis put these people involved, and they were part of the operation. Now, I think it does function in a different way with some people, which I've noticed, that it shows to them that the one cannot trust the official story because they didn't see fit to include part of the evidence. So it seems to me it works either way in some cases and other cases.
Okay, thank you. Roger Boris, Dr. Griffin, I'd like your comment on an experience I had. That is a gentleman formerly at Lawrence Livermore Lab who worked there, and now in the nuclear.
Who were you talking about?
A gentleman I know who's worked many years at Lawrence Livermore Lab.
Oh, okay.
Who's now a nuclear advisor to a 4-star general in Shreveport, Louisiana, raised over cocktails after dinner with me that we have no first strike policy. Russia does, China does. Why shouldn't we have a first strike policy to use nuclear weapons? I said, so what does a policy mean? Today you have a policy against first strike, tomorrow you change your mind. He says, well, I think we're going to use them. I said, why? He said, in the interest of the United States. I said, not my interest. I hope it's not your interest. Whose interest? Which he didn't answer. I'd like your comment.
Well, it's a very important issue, and will get even more important as Hillary takes office, because, as I said, she is so rabid both to get out Assad and Putin. And so there's been a lot of talk recently about getting rid of first strike policy. Obama recommended it, but then his people and his people in the Pentagon and the State Department and other advisors talked him out of it. Now, at least he gave in to their argument.
Thank you, Dr. Griffin. Is the next caller up yet? Someone else should be having their turn to speak. If your phone's been unmuted, it's your turn to speak.
Can you give me a second? This is Sheila. Why don't you have somebody go ahead of me?
You have to put yourself back on the queue, Sheila. Okay, that's the only way we can do it here. So that's okay.
Okay.
Oh, it's Craig McKee. I'm delighted to get a chance to speak to you again, Dr. Griffin, and I hope that there might be an opportunity to speak to you about the book once I've read it, but I won't put you on the spot about that now. But my question is, in 2011, you urged the movement to adopt a consensus position on the Pentagon. Since then, the consensus panel has failed to introduce any meaningful points that challenge the claim that a plane impact occurred at the Pentagon. And this seems likely to remain the case, given that it only takes 4 members to block any point. Also, the group that is pushing a plane impact, whose claims you refuted in your book in 2011, have become more and more aggressive in writing paper after paper, trying to spin the notion that they have proven their case and that we should all unite around their view. So I have my 2-part question is, why should we not consider the consensus panel to have failed when it comes to addressing the claimed impact? And also, what do you think about the campaign by Chandler, Jenkins, Cole, and others to convince the movement to follow them?
I had just decided when I wrote my previous book that it wasn't going to, you know, we weren't going to reach consensus. That group claims to be scientific, and therefore their view is right. And the other side, we believe our view is right, and we're not about to be convinced by data that could easily have been fabricated. That's at least my position. And so we would have I just decided that, and so we're continuing this with the consensus 9/11, that the really important question, and I know you and a lot of people don't agree with this, but the really important question is, the official story is false. So I've continued that in this book because Chandler and all the others agree that it would have been impossible for Honey to have flown that plane into the Pentagon. So to me, that seems like enough.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Griffin. Next question, I hope.
Hi, this is Kat. Can you hear me okay?
I can.
Yeah, okay. So much of the book is about Cheney, and I'm sure that you include the neocons, many of whom are Israeli firsters. And so I'm wondering to what extent, in the details of your book, you implicate Israel itself, the Zionists, specifically Netanyahu, from the Oded Yanon plan.
Yeah, no, I don't. I don't introduce that issue.
Do you believe in that issue? Do you know about it? And if so, is there a reason that you didn't introduce it?
Well, yeah, there's a reason. My book was going to be far too long as it was, and the main thing is, well, the other thing is, I don't accept the view that that the Israel or Mossad was central. That is, that some people say, well, they did 9/11. Well, no, most of 9/11 could have been done only by inside. Now, of course, there are many Israelis who are in the government here, but that mainly had to be people really in operational control. So that was Cheney primarily, who of course had been the Secretary of Defense, so he knew all of that stuff. And then his good buddy Rumsfeld was in charge, and so it was, I say, my view is it's basically a Cheney Rumsfeld operation with assistance from other countries, primarily Israel. For example, it seems like the guy that goes under the name of, that went under the name of Otta, his girlfriend said that he had he wrote sometimes in the Israeli language. So, and there were some others that seemed pretty clearly to have been Israelis, but they're, you know, bit parts, not not central to the operation.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Griffin. Another question?
Hi, this is Sheila, ready now.
Hi, Sheila.
I wanted to tell you, Dr. Griffin, that you are directly responsible for me waking up to 9/11 because I was idly browsing the Internet and came upon an article from David Ray Griffin. I'm sorry, from Paul Craig Roberts, and he said 9/11 didn't happen the way we were told. This was August of 2007. And he said, if you want to know more, read A New Pearl Harbor by David Ray Griffin. And I went and got that book that day and read it over the next 2 days. And basically I went from knowing nothing about it to, you know, full on made it happen on purpose and mind blown. So thank you for that.
By the way, most of the people I cite in my book are Democrats or not, at least not Republicans. But he may well be the guy I quoted most in the book, was Craig Roberts.
Well, he certainly has a lot to say about how we could soon be in a nuclear holocaust.
Yeah, he's one of the people who's most concerned about that, and I think rightly so.
I think so, too.
Thanks.
So my question was...
I'm sorry. I thought you were done. Please hurry, because there's a couple more people to ask, and we're way over time, okay? Who else is on the call to ask a question?
Can you hear me, David Cole?
Yeah, Sheila, I'm sorry to cut you off there. I didn't realize that you weren't finished. If you absolutely need to ask another question, please get back on the queue. Make it very, very brief, okay? David, please make your question brief. Thank you.
My question is about the most recent consensus point on Barry Jennings. I sent some clarifications and some new information. I was wondering if you had a chance to look that over. We're anxiously awaiting a reply from you and Elizabeth.
Yeah. We've looked at it and saw that you've got some interesting material there, but we have not had time to really focus on it because I've been, you know, finishing this book for a little over a year, and I had another couple books going too, and then she has just published a book on emergency climate change mobilization, and so she's been working on that for a long time. My name is also on the book, but she did all the work. When we're both just about free from these duties, so we should be getting back to it pretty soon.
Okay, thank you.
Uh-huh.
Okay, thank you. And Pablo, I think, is next. Pablo?
This is Pablo Novi. Hi, Dr. Griffin. My question is, at the last teleconference last month that you weren't able to make, we endorsed, as a group, we endorsed this thing that Ken called the 9/11 Unity Manifesto. The title on the actual document is End All the Wars in Police States Now. I'm wondering if you have seen that yet and what your opinion of it is if you've seen it.
No, I haven't. Could somebody email that to me?
Sure. I'll get your email address to Pablo. Pablo, you can email it to him tomorrow, okay? All right, let's see if there's anybody else on the stack. Sheila, yeah, you're back on. Ask your question very quickly, please.
Okay. In your book, 9/11, 10 years later, you say that you feel that what happened at the Pentagon, specifically what hit the Pentagon, is of secondary importance. And it sounds like you reached that conclusion because you feel that this has been destructive to the movement. I know that you also wrote a book about cognitive infiltration, and given that you yourself are convinced that no large plane hit the Pentagon, have you ever considered that perhaps the group that is arguing that a large plane did hit might be a group of cognitive infiltrators and not actually a group of genuine truthers?
No, I don't believe that for a moment. for example, David Chandler. I would never think he did anything dishonest. And several other people, too, but, I mean, he just stands out. But also his, well, I won't go into other names, but also you said I'm convinced. I don't think there was a big plane, but I wouldn't say I'm absolutely certain. So the miracle thing, those things I'm absolutely certain of. But, you know, there may have been some sort of way with, you know, electronic guidance that the plane could have hit that part of the Pentagon. So I don't completely rule it out. I just think there's so much evidence against it, and that this group uses this evidence from, you know, the instruments on the plane, and that could be so easily faked, I think.
Okay. Well, that I think that wraps it up. I don't think there's anyone else on in the queue, but let me just double check that. Anybody that hasn't spoken yet? So, is anybody
okay,
else on the queue?
So I'll say good night and let you people get back to your meeting.
Dr. Griffin, thank you so much for honoring us with your presence tonight, and I hope everyone will take the opportunity to follow your instructions to get your book, and we'll look forward to welcoming you back in the near future whenever you have time, okay?
Not only get my book, but you know, advertise it to everybody else you know who might be interested.
Okay.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Thank you again. Good night. Okay. So now we're running very far behind, and our next item is a brief summary by Barbara, who will update us on what the legal team from the Justice in Focus event in New York is up to, and then we'll have just a few moments for people to make very quick comments or ask very quick questions of Barbara. Let's see. I guess we got to. So, Barbara, let me unmute you, and the floor will be yours once you're unmuted here. Hopefully that'll happen very quickly. Mark.
Can you hear me, Ken?
Yep.
Okay, good. This is Barbara. I would just like to let you know, Ken, that I had pressed star 6 to try to ask a question of Professor Griffin, and apparently it didn't take, and I'm sorry for that, but it's not that big a deal because some of the questions were ones I would have asked anyway.
Well,
just so you know, the
feedback.
System
Thank
is
you.
Perfect.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, very, very briefly, I'd just like to give you all a thumbnail sketch of what has happened since the September 11th event. It was the second of the 2 days in New York City, which was a truly historic event. And I would like to jump off of what Professor Griffin said, that, and I agree with it, I'm sure we probably, most of us do as well, that we have more than enough evidence in the movement today to, and we have for many, many years, to prove the official story is a blood libel. That has justified all of these illegal wars and aggressions and shredding of the Constitution and such. So we need to have a next step in the movement. And the major next step that was taken on September 11th in New York City, and perhaps I believe Richard Gage is on the phone. He might want to address his important core aspect of that event as well. But the bottom line is we are now, as a movement, moving forward to taking very seriously, bringing the real perpetrators, identifying them, getting plaintiffs with standing, identifying the real perpetrators prioritizing who the defendants would be, who are still alive, of course, and moving forward to a real legal action or legal actions. And there are different possibilities for those, and that is still being discussed and determined. But the group is the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry that I was honored to participate in as the panel of question askers to listen to and hear the presentations by Richard Gage and others on the World Trade Center attacks 1, 2, and 7 at this event in New York City. So I think you all know that, and if you don't already have the link to all of the videos of that day's events, I will get that again, or Richard can, or we can both can, to Ken or Cheryl or Craig, and it's very, very important that you watch it. But where have we gone since New York City? Well, just in a thumbnail, where we are since New York City is the day after the Sunday, a September 11th event, there was what was called a strategy session, and it was very well attended. Richard Gage and myself and the leaders of the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry, who were the sponsors of the event along with architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth. And we all met, and Daniel Sheehan was there. Daniel Sheehan is someone I invited to participate as one of the lead attorneys in the event, and was one of the reasons it was so historic, and he was there. And the bottom line is we are moving forward to have an actual office in Manhattan, hopefully in Manhattan, but certainly in New York City, that will be a focal point for interviewing witnesses, doing whatever is necessary to move this forward. We're in a fundraising mode, and we are now in the mode of there are attorneys in the group, of course, mostly attorneys, 35 or 40 attorneys. But there are key attorneys in the group, the board of the attorneys group. And then there are those of us like David Cole and myself, Massimo Mazzucco, et cetera, who are working under the umbrella of confidentiality with the group as researchers, as official researchers with the group. And we're in the process of basically divvying up the potential defendants and looking at the evidence. For instance, we will, I'm sure, be mining Professor Griffin's new book. We'll be mining the book, Another 19. We will be mining everything, data mining, for the incontrovertible evidence and translating that into identifying the prioritizing defendants and identifying plaintiffs. And you can see just moving forward, it's going to be a long process. It's an iterative process. And that's where we are. And we're in the very first stages, but we're very serious. And there was a formal vote by the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry at the end of the September 11th event in New York City to move forward with this process in a very serious way. So if there are any comments or questions, both Richard Gage and
one moment, Barbara. Yeah, I want to try to unmute Richard's phone. I'm not sure what it is, but I'm hopeful it's the 760 number here. I'm trying to unmute it desperately, but it doesn't want to unmute. There we go. Richard, is that you? Richard? 760?
Am I unmuted?
Yeah. Is this Richard?
No, this is Dwayne Dietz.
Oh, sorry. Okay. I don't... maybe Richard is the 612 number. That's the only other one I can think of. It could be Richard. Is that you, Richard Gage?
Ken, no, I think no. He hung up. I think he has a 925 number.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So apparently we've lost Richard. So okay. If anybody, we'll go into Q&A mode. If anybody wants to make a comment, now this could be a question about to Barbara about what she's talked, or it could be just a comment on your take on the events of Justice in Focus, but they need to be extremely quick. We're talking about 30 seconds here, okay? So if you want to be on the queue, *6, and I'll have to unmute Barbara. Oh, Barbara, you're still unmuted. No, you're not. Okay, I have to unmute you. Star 6, if you want to make a comment or ask a question of Barbara. Star 6. Come on, unmute. Oh, this isn't going to work. We're going to have to go into discussion mode.
Gotten it started.
Okay, so if anybody wants to ask a question or make a comment, give me your name and we'll just do it the old-fashioned way. Who would like to be on the stack to make a comment or ask a question?
So,
nobody?
I have some
okay.
other stuff. That
I guess Barbara wrapped it up then. I guess everybody...
And I was wondering if you could grind it up. This one here is the sour beef.
I cannot tell if someone is asking a question.
No,
I cannot tell.
I think that's background noise.
Okay, well, that's it. Thank you for the opportunity to give you an update.
Thank you, Barbara, so much for the update, and we'll look forward to it. Do you think you could give us regular updates, Barbara? I'm going to go back into... I can unmute you, Barbara. I'll try it one more time here. It's going to take some work, I can see. Barbara, do you think you can give us a regular update on this from month to month? Kind of be our...
Sure, I'd be happy to. There may not be an update in a particular month, but we can schedule it as a regular year.
Okay, thank you so much. We appreciate that. I think a lot of people are keyed into that process. Okay, so we'll move on to our next item on the agenda.
I haven't done
and
any idea
that would be the report from Kat McGuire on the harassment of Chris Berlin when they were in when he was doing his East Coast tour. So, Kat, I'm going to give you the floor and I think I'm just trying to mute
and then they had
the background.
Two on, next inning, two on.
Whoever's
two out, and they didn't for a single round. Mike is free enough at the time, and then they got a
three-run
homer after that.
Yeah, I know. I'm
think
going
it's
to
coming from Craig?
Time. Yeah, it sure sounds like Craig.
Houston fishing, or Houston, Cleveland fishing.
Can we mute Craig here? Okay.
Can everyone hear me now?
Yeah. Yep. Go ahead.
Okay, thanks. All right. In New York, we were organizing two events around Chris Berlin, who came from Europe to give a tour. It was a small group, and it included Cheryl and Nita, who are part of our conference group, and a couple others. And we used all of our own money, so we weren't really a group. We were an organized group. It was just us. And as everybody knows, one of Chris's main talking points is about the connection with Israel and the Zionists there for 9/11. And he produces abundant evidence to that effect, which I would have liked to have grilled a little deeper with our speaker tonight, who question I asked. But in any event, there were concerns for the two events that we were planning around the September 11th time, and that's because in Greenfield, Massachusetts, they had to they were canceled three times and had to scout out three locations almost on the spot. I went to see Chris in Nyack, and he was supposed to be in downtown Nyack at a theater there. And we got there, and it had been rescheduled elsewhere because the theater owner had been threatened that, these thought police are saying who can talk and who can have free speech. And the theater owner even got a call all the way from Israel threatening him not to let Chris Berlin speak. So you know when people are not allowed to speak, who might really be having power going on here. So when we went to look for a venue, we had to be very upfront with people that there has been a harassment of people trying to silence free speech. We ended up selecting an Upper West Side Presbyterian church because we figured the Presbyterians were signed on to the BDS program. So surely they would be aware and in support of criticism of Zionism does not mean anti-Semitism. And then we also found Brooklyn Commons, where the owner of that community space, Melissa, was very committed to free speech. And so we passed out flyers, and maybe a big red flag was we put an ad in the Village Voice, and so that got a lot of publicity. That week, the Presbyterian Church canceled on us. I didn't find out until a Haaretz reporter was trying to get in touch with me. Fortunately, at the 11th hour, I was able to pull off an event on my building's rooftop, so we were able to talk on Friday. I have Chris give his speech on Friday. And I'll get back to the Presbyterian angle. So on Wednesday, we had Chris speak in Brooklyn, and Melissa, the woman who owns that Commons Center, got tons of pressure to cancel. The Zionists got many affiliated groups to sign a petition to boycott the Brooklyn Commons. They called her tenants. Yeah, she has a few tenants in the building besides having lectures that people can rent the space for. They called all her tenants to make their lease. One Commons tenant is a healer. They called her clients and told them to dump the healer if the healer doesn't break the lease. So there was quite a bit of pressure. And then that night, there were at least 15 or 20 protesters outside with signs saying Melissa is a collaborator, Chris is a Nazi, and ultimately it comes down to you're Holocaust deniers, you're Jew haters. And it was really contentious. It seemed to be organized by other people. These people barely seemed to know 9/11 issues, let alone how Israel was connected. Melissa had a security person she hired. We had hired one. But these people are like rabid settler types, if you've ever seen videos of the settlers. And one of them, I guess, managed to get in and spit on one of the Commons employees, so we had to have six policemen there. But we ended up with 30 people, we paid $10 each. A couple hecklers managed to get into the room. All of our security was outside. I personally had to go and physically eject this person. It was jarring. It was an ugly scene. They kept trying to bum-rush their way in to disrupt any way they could. And all of the newspaper accounts the next day were scurrilous. They all were basically saying that whatever he said was anti-Semitic, no matter what. One writer even said, well, as with every good conspiracy theorist, they even trotted out the Rothschild name, as if, see how lame this guy Christopher Lynn is. They were 100% closed-minded to listening to what he had to say. And all of the coverage was basically, well, we know he's definitely wrong, but one article said, let the poop speak. So in other words, we're way out there, but we deserve free speech no matter what. And their whole premise is the universal truth of anti-Semitism, and most reverted to the Zionist ace in the hole, the Holocaust, therefore. And it was just really sad that they wouldn't deal with the evidence, and it was just all ad hominem name attack, or naming, name-calling. He's an anti-Semitic Nazi. Over the course of the next week, it was a vicious witch hunt of Melissa by the Zionists. He held her ground. And interestingly enough, out of that, Norman Finkelstein heard about it and offered an 8-week free course entitled Should Fascists Be Allowed Free Speech? And the book to be read is On Liberty by John Stuart Mill. I'm in that course, as is Melissa. And it's amazing. I had no idea what a superb educator Norman Finkelstein is, beyond just being a brilliant writer. It's an incredible educator, and it is a criminal. He's a criminal, but he's banned from the classroom. He's an amazing teacher. And so we looked at the news the next day, and lo and behold, I was part of a hit piece that ended up in Jerez. The Presbyterian Church had completely sold me under the bus. They have a huge Jewish community that funds them quite a bit. And so they certainly weren't going to do anything to upset their one of their main funders. And so the pastor weighed in. We weren't even dealing with the pastor. The person we were dealing with obviously was not the decider. But he was trying to say we pulled a fast one on them, trying to get this anti-Semitic man in there. And we did nothing of the sort. They had to approve the flyer that had the URLs that they could have looked at themselves. So that was a main lie. And then just to give my name, and I had to take down my website. And based on what happened in Greenfield and Nyack and with Melissa, I feared for my job. So it was really scary. And we wanted to sue him. I feared the church would just view it as another opportunity to run to the Zionists to do more, show more brown-nosing loyalty. So I never even wrote them a letter to show how disappointed I was, and we couldn't file in small claims court because they illegally canceled on us. They didn't give us the 1 month notice, as our contract said. So it's just they are extremely organized, and they are out. They're as rabid as the settler types against the Palestinians. But it didn't necessarily end there. I'd like to say some stuff that's going on with Kevin Barrett, and then what even happened with us, and this is within our own truth movement. As some of you may have been following the 9/11 Truth Conference call listserv, a fellow truther denounced Chris, saying his events, quote, near 9/11 truth, it's defamatory to our movement. It has caused damages. And then, quote, Chris Bolin and his rabid band of Nazi-sympathizing fanatics have no place in this movement. And Kevin Barrett also has encountered this week, while he's in California, this resistance to other theories just because they happen to include Zionism. A Unitarian church in Berkeley canceled on him, a Unitarian church. Guns and Butter, they forced Bonnie Faulkner to eliminate 5 minutes from his Unitarian, talking about what happened at the Unitarian Church. And in Sacramento, an actual 9/11 truth activist himself, like he's on our list, or likewise tried to get Kevin banned. And so I feel like, you know, it's bad enough outside we've got these rabid Zionist settler types shutting down free speech in the name of anti-Semitism and being thought police. And it seems like 9/11 truthers are mirroring them and other conspiracy deniers because in our community, we've seen members making ad hominem attacks to silence and discredit the issues. Well, isn't that what the conspiracy theorists do to us? Why would we do it to ourselves? And then also when bona fide evidence is presented to users, they won't look at the facts. Instead, they just attack the messenger instead of putting forth a professional fact-based discussion. And that's what that's what Kevin Barrett has gotten this week, and that's what we got from this discussion we tried to have about the role of Israel in 9/11. Would not deal with the facts. Just kept calling us names. It's like some form of Stockholm syndrome. These people who are oppressing the truth movement in general, we have those in the truth movement who are likewise mirroring those kind of activities. So I'd like to say, please stop the censorship and name-calling. Free speech is not hate speech. We are not anti-Semitic Jew haters. So we need to have unfettered intellectual inquiry, please, with bad enough outside of the truth movement, let alone when people in the truth movement are mirroring in a Stockholm syndrome manner that same kind of closed-minded behavior. So that's my 10 minutes. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Kat. We should move on, but if anybody has an urgent question, we could take a moment for it. Does anybody have a question of what you've just heard from Kat? And if you're muted, just press *6. You'll be unmuted.
Ken, this is Cheryl.
Cheryl, yeah.
And I just wanted to add that what happened in Hartford, because we had Chris coming here on the day in between. He was at the two New York events, and again, it was at the Unitarian Meeting House, and we had told them in advance that they were going to get a complaint, and they said, oh, no problem, we paid them and everything, and then they also caved in on us. And they said that they were getting threats, and I guess they put horrible things on their website and Facebook page, because I guess they were open for people to do that from the outside. And they took them down before I could see what they were. But and they now believe that, you know, we're some kind of a horrible group that is anti-Semitic and all of that. So I'm working with them to try and show them that we're not like that. But, again, you know, I think they get some kind of donors and stuff coming from the Zionist community. So it's an uphill battle, but we're working on that. And that's
it.
It
sounds a lot like what happened with Tony Hall.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, can you hear me, Ken? It's Barbara.
Barbara, yeah, go ahead.
Thank you for, I didn't know if we were on discussion mode. I hosted, was one of the hosts of Kevin Barrett in Santa Cruz, California just last night. And it's interesting, we had, of course, Santa Cruz is called the People's Republic of Santa Cruz. It's so progressive, so left, but that's a good thing. And we had no problem whatsoever, so at least people need to know we have a free speech zone here in the Monterey Peninsula of California.
Can I say something?
Who's that?
Jonathan, Mark.
Mark, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, Jonathan. I just wanted to add in the with the Greenfield Library saying that they needed police protection. I contacted the library director, and she responded by email. Your first question was, where did the rumors of trouble come about to make you want those presenting to have police presence? The answer from Deborah Chandler herself, she was representing a 9/11 group, when she requested the use of our meeting room after the offer to host Christopher Berlin at the Greenfield Co-op had been rescinded, she was very honest with the library staff member responsible for booking our meeting rooms. She explained the situation with the co-op, and she stated that even within the 9/11, Valley 9/11 Truth Group itself, there was disagreement about sponsoring Mr. Berlin. Both of those raised red flags for library personnel on meeting rooms, policy states, and she goes into it. I just wanted to say that sometimes this issue brings up people that maybe want to make it into a right of free speech. My only question is, and I know I can't say I know for sure, but I think there's a possibility, and I got some resources from people that I trust stating that Christopher Berlin is actually a disinformation element to create this issue within the 9/11 Truth Movement to cause division. And I can't say if, you know, that's his intent or not, but it certainly seems to be the result. And any one issue, when that becomes the predominant issue and it basically creates a rift, we're not creating consensus, where I go with Griffin saying that the issue really is, you know, this was perpetrated by, and we know from Israel, from Turkey, from Pakistan, and more than likely, as David Ray Griffin's new book is about, Cheney and Rumsfeld and the neocons in the United States. As well as those that killed Kennedy and elsewhere. But the people that attract to Berlin, if he is a disinformation, is to create these issues, and then people don't even want to talk about 9/11 anymore.
I need to say something to that. This is Cheryl. Jonathan, do you have any kind of proof of what you're saying about Christopher Berlin? Because if you don't, then I think you should retract your statements about that, because it's just...
The American Free Press both sided with sources saying that Mark Lane, that was an attorney during the JFK disclosure, he was making Mark Lane into a Zionist, and he wasn't. And yet that you know, he was instrumental in that. And also from the American Free Press group, Berlin, they claim, is a disinformation person because he came and disrupted their organization, and they think that he's working for the other end of it. But all I can say is these are theories. I didn't see enough to say factual one way or the other, but I'm looking at the reaction and what it does. It's almost like the Judy Woods. I mean, when people really wanted that to be the issue, it just made people not even want to deal with 9/11 because it's not like what David Ray Griffin talks about. It's not the obvious that we can all agree on. It's a theory and one point of view. And if you make that too bit magnified, then it creates issues. And I think that's the situation that has happened, at least within my group. And I find people more than ever not want to deal with the issue of 9/11 because of you know, these extra issues that come around it. And some people that are, you know, really are, you know, over focused on trying to find someone to blame and having an answer. And I don't think we have the answer yet. I'm not saying it's not a possibility.
Okay. That's fine, Jonathan. I think you've answered Cheryl. We need to move on because we're so far behind time. But thank you all for your comments. Thank you so much, Kat, for your report. And now we'll move into Don Fox. Are you still on the call?
Yeah.
Good. Okay. So it's now it's time for our one of our presentations of this evening. Don Fox will talk to us about his analysis of the USGS and DOE evidence. The floor is yours, Don. I'm going to put us into lecture mode. It'll take me a second to Don. What is your Don? Wait a minute. What is your phone number, Don? Your area code, so I know.
612.
612. I'm going to have to mute you and then unmute you, I think.
Hey, Ken, it's Barbara. Yeah. A procedural thing. Some of us weren't able to get our star six.
I understand that, Barbara, and I appreciate your feedback. So what I'll do this time is after we're done with the Q&A mode, I'll say, did anybody not, was anybody unable to do that? So thank you for that feedback.
Yeah, put it in discussion mode for that. Thank you.
Okay. And again, you said, Don, it was 612, right?
Correct.
Okay, it's going to take me a little bit here to locate him. There he is. Let's see if we can unmute him here. Oh, he was unmuted. Somebody beat me to it. Probably Cheryl, huh? All right, let's try it again.
Okay, yeah, it said unmuted now.
There you are, Don. You're on. The floor is yours.
Okay.
Thank you.
Excellent. Okay. Yeah, I'll try to keep this brief since we're, you know, running so far behind. I'm working off of a PowerPoint that anybody can download off my blog. You can go to donaldfox.wordpress.com. It's the top post there. It's in Microsoft PowerPoint. You probably need the PowerPoint player. I think there's a free player out there you can use to view it. But with that, we'll get started here.
Repeat the URL, please, Don. Repeat
sure.
The URL.
Yeah, it's donaldfox.wordpress.com.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, so we'll, with that, we'll get going here. And the title slide shows the infamous Ground Zero pothole, and we will... We'll touch on that towards the end of the slideshow here, but that's a rather striking feature of Ground Zero that not many people talk about. And with that, we'll go to slide two. You know, we're not going to spend a ton of time breaking down dust samples. We've done that before, and then Wayne has put his view out there, and I'm going to add some new material to that. So what we're looking at here is the barium and strontium slide. So what we have is a correlation coefficient between the concentration of barium and the concentration of strontium of 0.9897 or near perfect. The maximum correlation coefficient that is mathematically possible is 1.0. And that would mean it would be a perfect match between the two factors we're examining, and all the data points would lie on a straight line with no variation. So it's almost perfect. So to get a correlation coefficient of 0.9897 with 14 samples around Lower Manhattan is very, very significant. So what that means is that whatever produced the barium produced the strontium. Our view is this is a sign of nuclear fission. Wayne Costey was threw out an alternative hypothesis that perhaps light bulbs, or this was just stuff that you would find in the soil regularly. So if that were true, if Wayne's view was true, then we probably wouldn't see cesium in there at the levels we do either. Slide 3 shows that just about all the samples had cesium in there. Now, cesium breaks down in the fission process into barium, and we find a ton of barium. So, but not all of it broke down, so we do find quite a bit of cesium in the samples. And then going to slide 4, so what is cesium-137? That's kind of one of the key isotopes in looking at nuclear fission. In everyday use, it's used for cancer treatment, to measure soil density at construction sites, ensure the proper fill level for packages of food, drugs. You know, it's used in medical devices, stuff like that. And as you can see there, it gives off kind of a blue glow, the cesium-137. So what is this blue glow all about? So we'll go to slide 5 here, and this talks about the nature of that blue glow. It's Cherenkov radiation. So what exactly is this Cherenkov radiation? Well, it's sort of the sonic boom for light. So when a charged particle moves through a medium at a speed higher than the speed of light in that medium, a faint radiation is produced in the medium. In water, for example, a charged particle will excite the water molecules, which then return to their normal state by emitting photons of blue light. Because the particle is moving faster than the speed of light in water, it can trigger a cascade of photons that are in phase with each other and can interfere constructively to form a visible blue glow. So one place you see this commonly would be in nuclear spent fuel rods, which when we go to slide 6 here, we see a pool of the spent fuel rods, and they do indeed glow blue. And then we'll go to slide 7 here, and this shows ground zero shortly after 9/11. It's a nighttime photo, and we can see a definite blue glow over the skyscrapers that are left. It's this ominous blue. And then the next picture, another picture of the ground zero destruction, more blue in the background there. And then we're looking at slide 9. So this takes us to the tributin light. That's something I think most of us are familiar with, where the I'm going to say the perps were behind it, wheeled out these blue spotlights. They were shining where the towers used to be. And there's a school of thought that the reason they were doing this was to cover up the Cherenkov radiation that was taking place at ground zero. The blue tributin light would provide cover for the cesium-137 and the strontium-90. And slide 10 shows a close-up picture of these lights. Okay, so that takes us to slide 11. Okay, now one of the main points I've been harping on for the last couple of years is that guys like us can debate what happened at 9/11, but the perps actually know what they used. So their actions can shed considerable light on, you know, what exactly did happen to these Twin Towers and the other buildings at the World Trade Center. So within an hour or two of Building 7 coming down, there were 125 dump trucks on the scene with dirt and this M291 resin. So they were doing soil remediation almost immediately after Building 7 came down. And if you study nuclear accidents or disasters, one of the first things you'll see is they do soil remediation. Like at Fukushima in Japan, they've removed enough soil from around Fukushima to fill 20 football stadiums of dirt. Okay, and then the next slide, number 12 here. This shows Ground Zero workers getting ready to leave the site. But before they go, they're undergoing a full decontamination. And here's guys in full suits, and they're scrubbing their boots and all the junk off them to get all the radioactive particles off of them. And then slide 13 here shows us Building 6. Big crater in the middle of the building, and Building 6 is what I call the mini nuke poster child, and we'll explain that in a bit here. And slide 14 shows the U.S. Customs personnel. Guy's looking out in Building 6. He's looking up at a huge hole in the roof of the building, and you can see blue sky up there. So there was a massive explosion that happened in Building 6. And as we go to slide 15 here, okay, so tritium was found in Building 6. And here's a graph that shows how much. Remember, the tritium found in Building 6 was found 11 days after 9/11, and it had rained twice, and millions of liters of water had diluted the tritium that was in the basement. And Ed Ward's fire hose water breakdown, he estimates there was probably 6 billion tritium units present in the basement of Building 6, say, on the evening of 9/11. And as we see on the chart here, that would put us up in the range of a leaking nuclear power plant, you know, hot fusion. So go to slide 16 here, and this is a picture from the New York Police Museum, and it shows some guns encased in cement, and the plaque on the wall states that Building 6, also known as the U.S. Customs House, stored guns there, and fire temperatures were so intense that cement in the building had melted like lava around everything in its path. So some of the speculation was that the tritium came from gun sites, yet none of the gun sites were actually broken open, and, you know, and on the contrary, most of the guns were found encased in cement, melted cement. So where else have we seen melted cement? Well, I did a little search, and lo and behold, I came up with Chernobyl. So slide 17 here shows what they call the elephant's foot from Chernobyl. It's a mass of cement, nuclear material, and, you know, some other junk that was just super hot and flowing. The scientists wanted a picture of it. They had to send in a robotic camera because it was so radioactive. Okay, and then slide 18 here shows us the Ground Zero pothole. It was a 40-foot deep depression on Ground Zero. And then here's slide 19. And this is another picture of the Ground Zero pothole, and this shows us probably one of the most unique features of the whole thing. It's a bunch of concentric circles. So it seems like whatever caused this pothole emanated from where the elite circles started. So it appears to be there was a lot of heat and explosive force here that caused this. The spin in the local media was that this was a depression caused by glaciers from 20,000 years ago. And it says, I think this is the New York Times, I believe, The areas in the local parks that have small vertical potholes exposed, said Cheryl Moss, the senior geologist at MUSER Rutledge. But I'm not aware of anything in the city as a whole, the self-contained depression on this scale. It's been called the Grand Canyon of Lower Manhattan. And Charles Mergerain, chairman of the geology department at Hofstra University, said he thought it was beautiful. He said, but it's very unusual to see such features near sea level. And the consensus was the presence of this high-pressure mineral called kyanite, that you would typically find something like this perhaps 20 miles below the sea. So usually this would be down deep.
Can you give us an idea of the dimensions of this pothole? Because it's hard to tell from the picture.
Yeah, it's like 40 feet deep, and maybe, you know, it points perhaps about that wide. You know, it was all filled in back in, you know, circa 2008. So it no longer exists. It was under Building 4. So this was in the southeast corner of the World Trade Center site. And my last slide here is slide 20. And this is a helicopter picture shortly after one of the towers had been destroyed. Now, this shows us very small particles getting ejected up from the World Trade Center area. And what would cause something like this is extreme heat. You know, temperatures hotter than the surface of the sun will cause material to break down into very small parts. And that's what it really means to get nuked, is the extreme high heat. So with all that tritium we see in Building 6, there can be little doubt that there was a thermonuclear event here at Ground Zero. And that concludes my presentation for this evening.
John, thank you for keeping that as concise as possible. Mm-hmm. And I would ask Craig to please link to your document in the minutes. So we'll go into Q&A mode if anybody has a question or would like to make a comment. Once we go into Q&A mode, you press star 6, and it should work, and then I'll ask at the end if anybody wasn't able to do that. And then, let's see, Don is 612. Oh, there he is. I have to unmute him. No, it didn't work. All right. This is not fun. I have to figure out a way to do this.
Ken, what are you struggling with?
We're trying to get Don unmuted, but I'm not able to unmute him. You want to try it?
Don? Okay, let me see. Yeah, I got
okay,
him unmuted.
Can you hear me now?
There you go. There you go. Okay, we got you
okay.
Now, Don. Okay, so okay, so star 6 if you want to ask a question or make a comment, and does it look like we got two people, so we'll get started. Wayne, go ahead. Pablo, you're first. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. Donald, are you aware of David Griscom?
No, I'm not.
Okay, he came out with the theory that Building 6 was nuked and not the twins. So you might want to get in contact with him. He's maybe the foremost collision dynamics expert on the planet, and he's also a truther.
Well, I all I would say is, you know, just for the sake of brevity here, that over two-thirds of the material from the Twin Towers was missing. It never turned up. There was no desks, chairs, phones, or even toilets found in the rubble of the Twin Towers. They were basically vaporized into millions of cubic yards of micronized dust.
You might want to get in touch with him.
Okay, I'll see if I can track him down.
Okay.
I have his email.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. We'll go to the next one.
Wayne, hello, is this the... Yeah, this is me. Thanks. I've got three items. So, Don, on your slide three, you mentioned the high levels of cesium-133. I don't know if you realize that in the presentation that I presented, which is slide, which documents the information, that cesium is much lower in the World Trade Center experience than the eastern soil samples. That was my slide 13. So I got two more points here. First, slide 15, where you talk about the tritium. 90% of the samples taken around the World Trade Center area had normal tritium levels at a normal background. Only the two that were in the basement were the ones that were high. And yes, there was water, there was other stuff, but we don't know what was going on there. And if there was an explosive event, I'd like you to address that. If there was an explosive event, why was not the tritium dispersed very widely? And the last one, on slide 16, talking about the pistols, it is well known that there was a thermitic material. The thermite is reacting at 4,500 degrees. Concrete melts at 3,300, and that is the most likely reason that there is concrete gun encased in concrete, as well as molten concrete encasing many other things too. The cesium, the tritium. Why wasn't it dispersed? Why was it only in two locations, the bottom of one building? And the molten concrete. So if you have any comments, I'd appreciate it. Thanks.
Okay. They didn't check the Twin Towers. And okay, so tritium, okay, and for those that aren't familiar with it, it's a heavy isotope of hydrogen. And the tritium you get from a nuclear explosion is almost all completely converted into water. Remember, and before they even they didn't take the sample in Building 6 until 11 days after 9/11. So it had rained twice. So if there was tritium in other parts of the site, it more than likely got washed away in the rain. Because in tritiated water behaves exactly the same as environmental water. So it probably went down the storm sewer, Wayne. And as far as the cesium goes, okay, well, if it wasn't cesium-137, and like I said, cesium-137 decays down into barium, and we've got sky-high levels of barium. Why were the perps doing a full nuclear remediation of the soil, Wayne? If this was just regular northeast soil, then why the hazmat suits? Why scrub everybody down before they leave?
Well, am I unmuted? I mean, the question, the answer to that, of course, is that there's all kinds of crap in the air, you know, is the terrible environmental disaster. Everyone was told about it except the firefighters and first responders who worked there. That's how it works.
And how does regular soil explain Cherenkov radiation?
I have no idea how that even is relevant.
What do you mean? Okay, wait.
The blue lights are showing from
cesium-137 gives off a blue glow, okay? It's a radioactive material that's very prominent in nuclear fission events. And we see a blue glow at ground zero. So we get the blue glow from cesium-137 and strontium-90. Where does the blue glow come from? If it's just regular background soil, Wayne, then why the nuclear remediation and why the blue glow?
Well, the blue glow, of course, many lights look blue depending on which kind of emergency lights that your lighting systems you're using. I haven't looked into this, but it's really a pretty tenuous thing. You take a look at pictures, nighttime visions of across cities, you'll see pockets of blue stuff, and there's no nuclear stuff going on there. It's just different types of lighting. Sodium, high-pressure sodium is yellow, but there are others that are bluish, and I don't know what the sensitivity of the film was that you were using. You can continue talking about what you want to talk about, but, you can have you got an uphill battle unless you're talking if you're talking to people who know something. So
I don't think it's an uphill battle at all, Wayne. I think you've got for 6 months after 9/11, there was the ground temperature there was between 600 and 2,000 degrees. Okay, there's no way a thermite reaction is gonna maintain ground temperatures that high, Wayne. Come on.
Okay. We can't do a full flood. Yeah, sorry, we can't do a full open debate here. But I would certainly invite the two of you to consider doing a debate in the future because I think it would probably be very edifying. We got to move on to the next person, and so everybody has a chance here. Thank you, Wayne.
This is Duane Dietz. The USGS survey did not provide information on the isotopes of the various elements that they measured, to my understanding. And it's been made in a number of the presentations that were against the idea of a nuclear event occurring, point out that it's the ratio between the proper isotopes that's important to be the, let's say, the fingerprint of fission. And to say that the ratio between particular elements really does not provide any information on whether there was fission or not. So what's your comment on that?
Well, the USGS personnel were chemists, so yeah, we don't have isotopic data, so we have to kind of look at the whole picture. And another thing I was informed of that, you know, USGS personnel, their instrumentation would not detect any transuranium elements either. So more than likely there was plutonium in the dust as well, but it's just their methodology wouldn't detect it. So what you have to do is you have to do a little homework, and you have to, you know, you have to do some pattern detection.
Well, I'll just leave it. I don't think that the idea of the ratios should be used as part of the argument, because those are ratios of elements. I'll just leave it at that.
Okay. All right. And next, I think, is David Cole. Go ahead, David.
Hello. I just wanted to offer a couple of points here about the claims about tritium under Building 6. I think if you study a report called Toxics Targeting, you'll see that the Customs House was storing radioactive materials there. The second thing is the often talked about bedrock, the cavity in the bedrock that was underneath Building 4, outside the bathtub, could not have anything to do with the destruction of the towers, wasn't in the right place. That's a natural formation. And if you Google the following, you'll find it very quickly. It's an article called Bedrock Control of a Boulder-Filled Valley Under World Trade Center Site. The third thing is the introduction of large quantities of soil onto the site were used for roadways, so that the trucks that were being loaded with the debris could get in and out without having tires punctured. They brought in enormous quantities of dirt, and that was just a necessity so that they could remove the debris quickly. I think that's really about all I had to say there.
Okay. Thank you, David. You want to respond to that, Doc?
Well, I guess all I would say is the perps knew what they were doing, and they knew they were going to need dump trucks. So, I mean, obviously, I guess all, and if you're on the call, I guess by definition, your hypothesis is this was a known event in advance. But I think you don't see dump trucks of dirt like this at a standard controlled demolition, I guess is what I would say.
Okay. Thank you. And let's see, we're going to go off Q&A. If anyone had any trouble that wanted to ask a question, this is the time to speak up. Anybody want to ask a question?
Barbara.
Barbara, go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Barbara, go ahead.
Oh, okay. Well, I have a comment and question for Dawn. The comment is, Dawn, thank you for your presentation. I think it's quite strong. I want to address and try to counter what Duane said, Duane Dietz, here in a minute. But I do want to say that in everything that you presented, I think the weak point that you should eliminate is the idea that the, you know, those blue light, blue-green lights that go up into the sky were a cover for the Cherenkov radiation. If I'm not incorrect, and you can check it out and correct me, but they didn't have those lights until a whole year after 9/11. Number one, and they only
it was within a couple of months. They were, and the ground was still 600 degrees in March of 2002. That's when the lights went up.
Okay, but allow me to give my second point.
Go ahead.
That is, having put up the third beam in the skylight myself personally. You know, our beam was precisely the same color, and it's just the color that it looks in the sky when, and it was miles from the two official beams. So that's just the color that a beam is with spotlights that you can purchase or you can rent. Number one, but number two, those lights were only up, even if it was only a few months after 9/11, they were only up for a short period of time. They're only up for, what, a few days, a week at the most? So even if they were a cover, they wouldn't cover for Cherenkov radiation for more than just a week. So I really think you should drop that. It's very weak. Because I believe that your presentation is quite strong, and I don't want it to be diluted, if you will. Sorry for the pun with all the water dilution. But I would like to get your comment on Duane's comment, because my understanding from your work and Prager's work, which I saw his PowerPoint slides before yours, and yours bounced off of his, is that the pairing of the elements, barium and strontium, I understand it, daughter products from the cesium, their pairings are inherently important whether the USGS actually looked for isotopes or just straight elements. Those are pairings of straight elements, and they're the strongest two pairings. It's the strongest pairing, but there are other not quite so strong pairings. But just looking at the barium and the strontium, isn't it important because they didn't actually look for the isotopes? It doesn't rule out that they are isotopes, and isn't the pairing inherently important for your argument itself? Thank you.
Yeah, it is a very key central point in the argument, yes. Strontium is a daughter product of rubidium, which we also see in the dust, and barium comes from cesium, and the cesium was decaying rapidly. So that's my thesis there. So if people say, well, there's no isotopic data, but yeah, we do see beta minus decay at ground zero. That's my point with the Cherenkov radiation. We can see beta minus decay.
I think I'm hearing you agree that just because USGS did not explicitly look for the isotopes of these paired elements, that the pairing themselves, the fact they didn't look does not rule out that
correct.
They were paired isotopes. Yep. Is that correct?
That's correct, yep.
Thank you.
Okay. Anybody else that didn't get a chance to ask a question or make a comment on our auto line? All right, good. Well, thank you, Don, for that presentation and for patiently waiting with us through this teleconference. Again, if you and Wayne would like to debate at some point, let me know. You know, we'll work it out. So moving on now to our next item, our last item on the agenda. Is Barton James on the call? Barton?
Yeah, this is Jonathan Mark. Bart Jordan. Bart, are you on the line?
Yes, I believe I am.
Oh, great. Very good. Okay. Well, then we're ready for our last presentation of the evening. And Jonathan will introduce Barton, and then we'll go from there. Go ahead, Jonathan.
Okay. First of all, I can, you know if people saw the video that I sent to look at, because the questions, those that seen the video, I'd be very interested in. But 10 minutes to describe Bart Jordan is, and his work is pretty difficult. But my background was as a activist working with Carl Grossman back in 1997, and that's where Flyby News came from, the Cassini Earth flyby. Not only was the Plutonian space probe a danger to Earth, but they had plans for taking over the world by putting weapons in space. So that's why Flyby News came to be and why we had to deal with 9/11, because they killed the ABM treaty after 9/11. And I soon found out that there's no truth in space. Without truth, there's no justice, and without justice, no peace. Bart Jordan contacted us in 1999 because of the Cassini flyby, which he learned from a press release that it had plutonium on board, and he was upset and wanted to make a commentary on it. And like anybody that's, you know, trying to look serious in this world, my partner Earl Budin, who was the first person that Bart contacted, wouldn't talk to him because he talked about these ancient advanced civilizations over 100,000 years ago. And but I'm open to that. And then the first Flyby News challenge, because I didn't want to keep it up if it wasn't true, was to get someone to give me another explanation for how figures got into the Encyclopedia Britannica in 1966, and was there for 7 consecutive years, about the distances of the 2 moons around Mars. And Bart Jordan did an article on it and had a lot of information. So that still stands. No one can give me another explanation. This was years before NASA could confirm it. And Bart Jordan has gave me the story where he was 8 years old in the Manhattan Project. And I decided that he's going to be totally honest or he's going to be totally a crook. But no one's smart enough to be a crook in such levels. So I'm going to just put him on because I can't do him justice. And then he'll take your questions. Bart, can you take over for me?
Oh, surely. I don't know exactly what direction we need to go in. I mean, I don't know where to start.
And that you're working on for November and what you're trying to do, improving your work with the Mars Mariner and also the Mars Viking missions, and what proofs you have about your work in the Manhattan Project and how that...
Well, of course, it started for me in 1942. When I was 5 years old, and I was under the aegis of my grandfather, who insisted when I wanted to learn the family languages of German and French, he said no. And the no resulted in my look at him that said, well, then why not, even if I didn't verbalize it. So he said, first, Greek, Hebrew and Aramaic, and of course Latin, but the ancient languages first. And he said Greek is the oldest language in the world, despite many people who think otherwise. And so we started there, and I started to analyze the Iliad and the Odyssey. And the first thing I did was count the lines in Greek, because it doesn't do any good to count, you know, translation lines. They don't mean anything. But the actual lines in Greek, and they were all in hexameter, which, of course, is very awkward Greek in any period of time. But I discovered that there were 15,693 lines in the Iliad and then 12,109 lines in the Odyssey. And I heard various ideas as to why there were fewer in the Odyssey than, and notably fewer, but nobody ever decided to put them together and see that the total was 2,780,2. And I realized after a time that the 2 that introduced the 780 was the solar 2, and that the one on the other side was lunar. But that the 780 was the synodic revolution of the planet Mars, and this was an indication of the god of war. So I just proceeded from there. And when I broke down the names of Aris, that's Mars, Phobos, Harmonia, Deimos, and Aphrodite, which is Venus, I realized that the Greeks, because each letter is a number, of course, the Greeks had a reading of 309, 842, 272, and that would be the one that would be a palindrome. From either direction, it would read the same. That's harmonia. And then deimos, which is 329, and 993 was aphrodite. And so, or aphrodite without her nighty, as I sometimes said to vex my family. But I said that it's odd. It's 2745. And the more I looked at it, the more I realized, ah, if Venus is this, or Aphrodite is this goddess of the mirror, what happens if you turn them around? Instead of 309, you had 903, and so on. What would happen then? Well, it came out to the same calculation. So I said, wait a minute, there's something going on here. And then I looked at the process of how in this might relate to some isotopes, and they were more concerned.
I'm not going to cover it all. I'm
Pardon?
You can summarize in a more general fashion, because you...
Oh, you're, okay. You're, well, I... What, my point was that I...
Cover up.
Okay.
And
all right. I don't know. See, I saw those as the core of everything I needed to do. And when I found that I was being questioned by Robert Wood, and he wanted me to meet with Alfred Loomis and also Ernest Lawrence, because I had drawn a picture of this treatment of the light. And I said, this is something that we're engaged in trying to do, apparently. And Dr. Wood said, yes, it's, what does it represent? And I said, well, it represents the abuse of the light. And at the same time, it must be something wherein something nuclear was being tested. Now, at this point, I'm 8 years old, but I've had 3 years to think about this. And so Robert Wood said, well, I think you need to meet with my colleagues and so on. And to make a long story short, I then projected what would be the result of a explosion, implosion, explosion, like the raindrop with refraction, reflection, refraction. And I was able to determine for the first 15 milliseconds exactly what the dimensions of this explosion would be. And this way, to keep our scientists safe by having the bunkers in the tower at a specific distance. All of these things the government had. And then I used the same self-same personages, if you will, in the Greek to follow down on what was the site on Mars. And I fixed it at 4087 north. And the reason for that was that the distances between the Martian moons and Mars center were for Deimos 14,615 miles and Phobos 5820 miles. And again, the total was 2435. And I simply divided it by 5, for I felt that this was north 5, and sure enough, 4087 came right up very quickly. And so I said, well, this must be the site that they are concerned with. And there was a concern also amongst the, not only the Greeks, but there was a concern amongst the people who wrote in Aramaic in the Torah. And so I worked with that. That would be the Garden of Eden, and so on and so forth. And all of these questions I eventually put into a theory that the site was with a warning, a very pronounced warning against the use of nuclear things. And of course, then I plotted the spacecraft. I plotted the Mariner 9 and the Viking 1. And thanks to the yeoman of NASA, who did a good job with maintaining the tracking systems, the two frames that were so important, frame 35, A72, and the A simply stands for Viking 1, and then 35 orbits later, 70A13, these would show the, if you sort of dock them in space, hypothetically, the two triangles would result in fixed on vectors, were fixed on 4087. These would show a particular alignment that was 92.575 miles total, and that this area would be what would give the warnings in very clear dimensions of what the nuclear use would result in. And the warning was, do not use the 235, because that's fissionable in nature. And it in itself, when figured to six places of decimal, which nobody did in 1945, that was alone on my part. And I did four isotopes. I did 235, 237, 238, and 239. And the 235 and the 239 were fissionable, and the others were not. So I simply organized the stuff, and I made it clear to the scientists in 1945 that the 235 was not to be used. We would need it later. But that the 239, we wanted to have the test in such a way as it would result in the first 15 milliseconds, where in the altitude of the upthrust of this bubble, if you will, would be 140 meters high, and the base would be 280 meters across. And otherwise, it would look like, with the ejector blanket, something like a kilt or whatever on the bottom of this half 180-degree unit. And the first milliseconds, 6 milliseconds, would give the 180, and then it would repeat again at 15 milliseconds, 9 milliseconds difference. And that if these could be predicted right down to the penny, which is what I did, then it would be something we could depend on as a test and invite the enemy. And that was the idea, because the only enemy left at that point was Japan. Germany had capitulated already, ended the war in Europe. So I put this forward as the idea, and my grandfather and I had worked on this, and we were given the assurance that there would be no use of the 235, and that the 239 would be the test that the enemy would be invited to. There was the betrayal, because this is not what happened, and everyone knows what happened. They used the 235 on Hiroshima and the 239 on Nagasaki. And I had given the isotopes for these things. Now, it was reflected also on that site on Mars, and it was very, very clear. And so I said to NASA, when they had, I tried not to reveal too much, but when they had the information, I said, now, why will you not then tell the public, as you should, and if you tell the American public, you will tell the world, that this has a very clear statement of we need to put these weapons away because it will result in our demise. And I was very, very clear about every detail of it, and those dimensions that are given in the Britannica from 66 to 73 were predicted before the spacecraft got there and confirmed it. And I think that this is what's wrong. We have plenty of evidence of what we need to do, and it's going to take the cooperation of all the scientists throughout the world in order to remediate and to negotiate the way of looking at this world that we have left to us, because we are fouling our own nest, and there's no end to it, and I'm sick of it, because I think that there's no need for this. There are nuts in the military who believe that the area of Cydonia has space weapons that can be used from space that are devastating to the world. And I said, that's absolutely, totally wrong. What is there is a site that was deliberately but selectively damaged in order to demonstrate to us what we should not do. And I think that we need to really consider what is there. And NASA has to be coming out with the facts of what they know, because they've not done this. And the Rendlesham Forest incident, for example, that triangular craft that set down there, it didn't crash, it set down. those two airmen that saw what they did, and the sergeant in particular, putting down the thing and pointing the 9.8 on each corner of the distances, all of those were reflections of what we were still being seen as being on a suicidal mission with relation to this planet. And that spacecraft, wherever it did generate from, or come from rather, it generated the exact same information that we had in the Trinity in 45. So I think the point is clear. If we want to do something, then we better get about it because we're running out of time. And this is not something you can play with. We don't have any way right now to even deal with what is the depleted material that we have. There's no place it's safe to bury anything, obviously, and so on. I mean, there are many questions here. But the things that we can answer through the expression of what the ancient cultures left to us are very, very pointedly saying to us, you do this differently or you will perish. And that's why on that particular site, which is at the top of the frame of 35A72, it shows this three-sided wall. Now, nature doesn't do this. It's a three-sided wall. The top wall is 6,080. That's the Admiralty Mile. And then it's followed by 5280 and then 4480. And the total, of course, is league. Now, that is not a mistake. That is something that is telling us something, because the wall which points straight down is the offspring wall. And that is damage from the air. It's a nuclear strike from the air. It is not something that somebody blew up on the land. And the black shadow next to it is where they eliminated the design unit that showed the offspring. So we have evidence, and it's very cogently stated evidence, and it's in line with what is the original line count of the Iliad and the Odyssey. Homer knew what he was looking at, and he knew how to present it. By the way, the three names that apply are Omeros, Duphilos, Aoidos. Those are the three names, and everybody knows Homer, but they don't know what the rest of it is. And the Duphilos is blind, and the latter part is singer, but it means like a chronicler singer, not somebody who yodels on the back porch. So what we are getting from this man who left us the greatest epic that's ever been written on war is that we need to do something that is going to require everybody's effort and attention, and we must do it before it's too late. And possibly it is already too late. But if we want to go down better than not, we better get about trying to do something.
Okay.
And I think that's really a summary of what I'm saying.
Okay. Thank you, Bart. Thank you for that presentation. It was pretty technical, and a lot of us didn't have the visuals to work from, but hopefully people that want to can go back and listen to the call and review it with you, the visuals at another point. And Jonathan, would you send an updated version to Craig of that proper URL so that it goes into the minutes so people that want to can view it while they're listening to the call, okay?
I will, and it's also flybynews.com right under the first paragraph, but I'll send it to
you. Okay. So, we're way over time here, but if anybody has something that they'd like to add by way of a comment or a question, we can probably do that very quickly. Does anybody want to just say that they'd like to ask a question or
Barbara?
Make a comment?
Barbara,
anybody else? Okay, Barbara, if it's just you, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you so much, Bart. Is it Bart or Barton?
Just Bart.
Bart, thank you so much.
Yeah, it's the German word for beard.
Okay.
B-A-R-T.
I presume you have one.
No, I don't.
Oh, okay.
Well, if I'm 69 and I was born in 47 and you were born in about 37, I guess you're almost 80 years old. Is that right?
That's correct. A couple of months.
Yeah. Well, I'm so glad you're still with us to warn us about this. My comment and question briefly is this. Do I understand correctly that the Trinity test, which you inputted to, was not either, what is it, is it 135 or 139? What is it?
No, it's the 239.
I'm sorry,
it's
it
plutonium.
Was neither 235
plutonium.
Nor 239. It was something else, but Hiroshima was 235 and Nagasaki was 239. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And what
and
was
there
it
was
at
no
Trinity?
Need. Well, let me just comment on that directly. There was no need because the test would have been the same in terms of dimensionality for the 235 and the 239. There was no need to use the 235, and I asked it to be not used because we would need it later. And
right. So my question is, what was Trinity? What was used at Trinity?
Well, the Trinity was the test of the 239. And
it
the point is, it was 239 is what we used. And the point is that it had a clone, or its dead-on twin, was what leveled Nagasaki.
No,
I provided all the heavy isotopes. I provided them to sixth place in decimal. So there was
right.
no excuse
so
to do anything.
So clarifying that, why do you think our military did what you warned them not to at Hiroshima and Nagasaki? Why?
Why did they do it?
Yes.
Is that what your question is?
Yes.
Well, because some people just have a level of ignorance and arrogance to go together, like horse and carriage, love and marriage. I mean, I don't know. I mean, you'd have to ask them. I would
think that they actually wanted, and we know that they have, and it's mostly still classified, they wanted to know the effect on human beings, and they had to use them to find out.
Well, no, they only had to use the 239, and the point is, if they wanted that, they certainly had our own soldiers go marching right toward the ground zero, and we have pictures to that effect. The fact remains that what it was largely reprisal. But the point is, once they had put the 235 into the mix, they were damned if they weren't going to use it. And they made Oak Ridge and modified Hanford, Washington, in order to accomplish that. But they should never have used the 235 because
right.
it had less than 1% in nature.
I understand. And last question, how do we know, or how do you believe or know, that 235 was used at Sidonia on Mars?
Well, I'm saying that the 235 was not used. I said it had a reference that said, do not use the 235. In fact, don't use either one. But the point was that they made it very clear that the 235 was not to be used, and exactly why it was not to be used was not spelled out. But the
right,
point
but
is
you
the
have told us that there's evidence of a nuclear event at Sidonia on Mars. Do we know what was used?
Yes, it was the 239.
Thank you. All right, thank you for the clarification.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you, Barbara. Anybody else need to ask a question or make a comment before we go to our announcements? Oh, good. Thank you. Thank you very much, Barton.
You're welcome.
Bart Jordan, for your presentation. And if people want more information, of course, Jonathan Mark will provide us with the URL, and we can go from there. Final part of our call, as always, is announcements. Does anyone have an announcement to leave on record before we close tonight?
Well, the debate will be in January instead of November.
I'm sorry, can you repeat that, Barbara?
Craig and I have agreed to debate in January. Craig asked to delay until January, and I agreed.
Huh. Okay, so that would be the third Pentagon debate. Craig, are you confirming that, right? You and Barbara will be debating that in January?
Am I unmuted?
You're not muted.
Oh, I'm not muted. Okay, good. I didn't know. Yes would be the answer. Yeah.
All right. So we'll look forward to that. And then any other announcements?
This is Wayne.
Wayne?
Yeah, I just want to announce that I'm going to be requesting 15 minutes of the next teleconference to go over the evidence for the Lloyd taxicab accident or incident reviewed as a accident scene and looking at the evidence that is there. So I'll be sending that as a written request, but I want to let everyone know that I'll be doing that, and we'll see how it goes. Thanks. Over.
Okay, thank you. And any other announcements?
Barry Zwicker here. Can you hear me?
Barry? Yes, yeah. Barry, go ahead.
Yeah, less than a minute here. Very terrestrial question, actually. I'm hoping participants on tonight's call, if they want to and if they're able to, could respond to one research question I have. And my research is into Friday's widespread distributed denial of service attacks, known as DDoSs. Probably everybody's familiar with that. So mainstream
just
media...
Just KCR, what is a DDoS attack?
That distributed denial of service attack is where someone, and it's a puzzle as to whom would have done this on Friday, prevents people from reaching particular websites, prevents people from reaching particular services like Google or Amazon. And it happened and was widely reported in the media. I don't want to take more than a minute. You can look it up, DDoS. It's a known phrase, and it covered most of Eastern North America, including up here in Canada. So I had a personal experience where I couldn't reach certain websites that day, and later I learned about this huge attack. So I'll get down to the point here. I'm just asking anyone here who's listening, if they experienced anything odd or unusual in their internet usage last Friday when the DDoS attack happened, and it'd be very valuable to learn whether they did, because it could be that NSA was conducting a beta test to find out if they could hobble people like us who are on this teleconference. That's and I'm sort of collecting information as I can. I already queried a number of truth or friends, and of the four who responded, three noted a pattern of being unable to reach certain sites. And so my email address I'll give right now in case anyone had anything to share with me. My three initials, BWZ, that's Bravo Whiskey Zulu, at bell.net. And
okay.
And then in the minutes of this meeting, my phone number will be included if anybody wants. If my research amounts to more than a hill of beans, I'd be willing to share that on a future teleconference.
Very good.
Could you
Thank
tell
you
us, Barry, what you were not able to reach that day?
The first place I couldn't reach, and this was before I knew the attacks were going on, was the website of the Hamilton Spectator newspaper, which is a large and well-known newspaper. And it happened that the very day that I couldn't reach that newspaper, there was an op-ed page piece by Graham McQueen, I think most of you know him, which asked questions about the Parliament Hill shooting in Canada here on 2014. He raised serious questions about it, which is very difficult to raise in this country. And then a friend of mine couldn't reach the Guardian. When I tried just to Google Edward Snowden, Edward Snowden on WikiLeaks, I couldn't reach WikiLeaks. I started to time it, and after half an hour, I gave up. So there was definitely something happening, but it was news in all the papers. You can look it up. And what I want to try to find out in a very amateurish way is, do people I know who are, shall we say, radicals or dissidents or potential enemies of the state, did they have any experiences peculiar to themselves? Only what the facts are. And this may amount to nothing, but it may amount to something. Someone has to try to research it.
Well, I do have something important everyone should know. It's Barbara. And in 30 seconds, there's a program called The Other Side of Midnight. It's an online radio program with Richard Hoagland, the host, who was Walter Cronkite's NASA and Space Advisor, for about a decade. It's a great show. It goes from midnight to 2 o'clock West Coast time. When he had pre-announced, I've been on the program for a total of 10 hours on 9/11, and it goes to about 170 countries. So it's the number 25 listened to online radio show in the world, according to their kind of Arbitron ratings. He pre-announces his guest when he pre-announced having Roger Stone on the program. And Roger Stone self-identifies as the hitman for the Republican Party and was the senior advisor to Donald Trump until August. And Stone acknowledges that he is the Trump campaign direct communication link to WikiLeaks to Julian Assange. Just the night that program was to come on, not only was the program taken down, but Richard Hoagland, the host's telephone, were taken down as well out of his studio in his home in the Southwest, so that he could not even record Roger Stone for later broadcast. And this has happened again, and now his entire program has been taken down. Now, it may now be back.
What was the date when the program was first taken down, to your knowledge, Barb?
I'll have to go on to the website. I will send that to you in a few minutes.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And Barbara, ask him if he wants to interview Bart Jordan, since they're both
what?
The old Cydonia region.
What? Couldn't hear you.
Oh, this is Jonathan Mark. I wanted you to ask Richard Hoagland if he would interview Bart Jordan because of the Cydonia region. He's made so much.
Well, absolutely. I'm working with Richard Hoagland's producer behind the scenes. They asked me to do the research, the backgrounder on Roger Stone. So I will definitely do that. Bart, do you already know Richard Hoagland?
Bart's off the call.
Okay. Well,
he has a lot of complaints about him, but it should be an interesting call.
Okay, before we go, I want to piggyback on what Barbara said, that particular bit of censorship. I've also heard, I don't know how much truth there is to this, that Rick Savage lost his show because of something he said there or was doing.
Michael Savage,
Michael Savage, I'm sorry, that irritated the powers that be, that was very problematic for them. And I don't recall all the details. If somebody can fill in, go ahead and please do that.
I can do that because I just read an article on it.
Thank you, Cheryl.
He was talking about Hillary Clinton having Parkinson's, and he was mentioning the drug that she was taking, which was levodopa or something. And when he said the drug, they cut him right off the air from the main station that he works with. And I guess he was on 400 other affiliate stations, and he kept going, but then after a while they cut him off on all of those also, is my understanding. And I don't think he's gotten back on. But I don't ever listen to him, so I couldn't.
Whoever's coughing, please mute yourself, okay? Okay, thanks, Cheryl. So sounds like censorship is really ramping up. We should be on the lookout for that and try to make updates on that whenever you have information like that. Any other announcements before we close tonight?
Yeah, so Jonathan Mark, May 29th is Kennedy's 100th birthday, and I wrote to Carl Golovin, who has been very involved with making that a significant time, to maybe come on the teleconference. So I just want to give you a heads up.
Oh, yeah, cool. Way to go, Jonathan. Thank you.
Oh, I do have an announcement, Barbara. I happen to be at Danny Sheehan's office, the famous attorney, in Santa Cruz 2 days ago with he and his wife, Sarah Nelson. And we were supposed to have lunch. I walked in, and he could only talk for about 15 minutes because he was about to go on the Gary Null show, which reaches, according to Gary Null, about 93 million listeners a day, on the subject of 9/11. So I just want people to know that I personally am responsible for bringing Danny Sheehan out of the closet on 9/11 Truth. If you'd like to listen to Danny Sheehan's program on 9/11, it was part of Gary Null's fund drive. That was just 2 days ago, so that would be Monday.
Well, that's interesting, Barbara, because he had a four-part interview with Danny Sheehan before, and he kept talking about that they were going to talk about 9/11, and they never did in all four of those parts.
Yes,
I kept waiting for it.
And I know what's behind that. Danny did not want to be public about it until the New York City event on September 11th. But now he's out of the closet.
Ah, right. So can you supply the URL for that, Barbara? Would you be able to have it?
I haven't gone there to listen to it myself. I couldn't listen to it live, even though I was literally 10 feet from him. He had to close the door because he was on air, and so I had lunch in the other room. But I will listen to it, and I'll do my best to find it and get it to you.
Thank you so much. Okay. Any other announcements before we close? Okay, hearing none, thank you all for your patience tonight and your cooperation, especially with our new system and our getting used to it. And we'll see you all hopefully at the same time and place last Wednesday of next month on the 30th of November. Have a good night. Peace.
Thank you.
Bye, everyone.
Good night.
Bye.
Bye.